I'm Kevin Clark, Senior Editor and Chief Correspondent for America Magazine. Today I'm speaking with Professor Douglas Castle. Professor Castle is a Notre Dame Presidential Fellow and a Professor of Law at Notre Dame School of Law. And we're going to be talking a bit about the incredibly leaking CIA report that is still technically secret. A report conducted by the Senate has been leaking madly into the McClatchy newspaper's Washington Bureau, and a lot of it's been coming out in the press. Professor Castle, what are we finding out from this leak about the Senate's investigation of the CIA and its activities during the war on terror?
Well, in a nutshell, we're finding out that the CIA tortured more people more harshly, more often, with fewer results than they claimed to the American public and the American Congress, and that they lied to the American public and Congress about what they were doing and about the supposed benefits of what they were doing.
Well, when you put it like that, it sounds really bad.
It is really bad.
Yeah.
Torture is one of the crimes under international law for which there is never a justification, a lawful justification, and it's illegal under United States law. It's illegal under the United Nations Convention Against Torture, to which the United States is a party. It should never have been done, even if it had been valuable in producing intelligence, and we're now finding out that it wasn't even valuable in producing intelligence.
Now, defenders of the CIA's programs, which included the controversial program to interdict suspects and take them to, redention?
Black sites.
Yeah, black sites are all over the world, in Central Europe and the Middle East. They've talked about this program as being crucial to the anti-terror efforts of the United States. They've talked about these things not really being torture, but in enhanced interrogation. Does this report that the Senate is still, which, by the way, is still not public, still tied up in the Senate, does this put that to bed, that these techniques were within the law?
Well, it won't put it to bed because the defenders of the CIA, including the former interim director of the CIA, continue to defend what they did. So this controversy will go on. But the important point is that the facts need to be put out on the table before the American public. The Senate Intelligence Committee has just spent 4 years investigating millions of CIA documents and the case files of over 100 people who were allegedly subjected to harsh treatment. And they have over a 6,000-page report. Put that out there in the public. Let us debate it in the open. And if the CIA wants to defend what it did, let it do so on the basis of public information rather than on the basis of a CIA spin of still secret information.
Now, we've all heard about waterboarding and sleep deprivation and some of the other techniques that the CIA has acknowledged using as part of its quote-unquote enhanced interrogations. Does this report include evidence of even harsher treatment of people who have been arrested by CIA and federal authorities?
Well, of course, I haven't seen the full report. I've only seen the same news leaks that are in all the major media. But it does reveal additional techniques that I at least had not seen publicly reported before, namely dunking prisoners into pools of frozen water, not frozen, but ice-cold water, until they were choking, and then all the while beating them with truncheons and bashing their head against the wall. Now, because that particular, in at least three cases, facts like those are alleged according to the news leaks. Now, because I haven't seen the detailed report by the Senate or the underlying documents, all I can say at this point is that there are allegations of harsh techniques that would amount to torture, which have not, to my knowledge, previously been reported.
These are. This is the finding of the report, though. That was one thing that was leaked, were the 20-point findings of the Senate investigation, that treatments were much harsher. Were much harsher than people realized.
That's certainly what the Senate is claiming. And frankly, at this point, I'm more inclined to trust the version of the Senate than the CIA, which has an obvious conflict of interest. But on the other hand, until this report is declassified, we can't really make definitive statements as to who's wrong and who's right in this debate. What we're talking about is a Senate report that needs to be made public, and needs to be made public through a declassification process that is not presided over by the CIA, which seems to be the current situation, at least as of a few days ago.
And the White House has pretty much been following the lead of the CIA at this point.
Well, the White House, President Obama has said he's in favor of declassifying the report, but a White House spokesperson says that the declassification process will be presided over by the CIA. Now, on April 11th, Senator Mark Udall, who's a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, echoed statements by other members of the Senate, of the House, and of various human rights groups urging President Obama not to allow the CIA to sit in judgment on the declassification of its own alleged misconduct, and to have either the White House or some other body be in charge of the declassification process. I just checked Senator Udall's webpage this morning, and I'm not aware if there has been a White House reply to his request.
Yeah, that is sort of the classic Fox overseeing the hen house dilemma, I imagine.
Exactly.
Is there evidence that, now this program, as I understand, officially came to a conclusion in 2006, is there evidence that these kinds of interrogations are still taking place? I mean, there are still active terror interdiction programs going on around the world.
Well, the CIA black sites were allegedly closed in 2006 by an order by then-President Bush, but it was not an order that precluded the possibility of reopening them. Over the years, there have been some reports, not so much that the black sites have been reopened, but that some of these harsh interrogation techniques have been used on a sporadic basis here and there. I don't know whether those reports are addressed in the Senate Intelligence Committee report, because it principally covers the period 2002 to 2006, when even the CIA acknowledges that this program of what they call harsh interrogation techniques and what international law calls torture was ongoing.
Now, they had been provided some cover for these interrogation techniques by the Bush White House, with some findings from their legal staff. Why did they go beyond what some would say was the too generous parameters offered by the Bush White House?
Well, the legal advice actually came from the Office of Legal Counsel of the Department of Justice, and particularly a lawyer in that office at the time by the name of John Yu, among others. Now, that legal advice indicated that the president had the constitutional authority, according to John Yu, to essentially do whatever was necessary, including torture, to win the war against terrorism. Now, that legal opinion was subsequently repudiated by the Justice Department and withdrawn, the only case I know of where the Justice Department has ever withdrawn an opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel, and officially is no longer U.S. policy. Now, one of the intriguing new leaks from the Senate Intelligence Committee is that there's a claim, apparently, that the CIA provided misleading information to government lawyers who provided authorizations for them to proceed. Now, until we see at least the 400-page executive summary of the Senate report, which is what is up for declassification now, we won't know whether the legal opinion from John Yu and the Office of Legal Counsel was in part based on misleading information provided to them by the CIA, or whether that reference to misleading government lawyers refers to some other lawyers, not John Yu.
Yeah, and that report, the Senate committee has voted 11-3 to declassify that report, and that's what we're talking about now. That's what's being slowly leaked to the public.
Well, the vote was, at this stage, to declassify only the executive summary, which is 400 pages. There's another 6,000 pages to the report, which Senator Feinstein, the chairperson of the committee, has indicated that the Senate committee may decide to vote on declassifying in the future. But so far, they've voted only on the declassification subject to what she calls minimal deletions, if necessary, of the 400-page executive summary.
Now, in the 70s, we had the Church Committee investigations of CIA activities, specifically, I believe, regarding assassinations. Is this something that every 10 or 15 or 20 years we're going to have to revisit? It seems like this is the CIA of old, misleading Congress, torturing people in their control, and going beyond the parameters of their authority.
Well, the CIA, the Church Report back in the 1970s looked at CIA, FBI, and other intelligence agency excesses, let's put it that way, that included but were by no means limited to assassinations or attempted assassinations of people like Fidel Castro. But on your broader question, whenever you have powerful agencies with a large budget operating in secret, subject to congressional oversight, but congressional oversight limited to a small number of members of Congress who tend to develop a relationship with the CIA and to believe what the CIA agency officials tell them. And whenever there is a perceived national crisis on the part of the CIA, back in the 1960s, of course, it was the Cold War struggle with the Soviet Union. Now, or rather, in the first decade of this century, it was Al-Qaeda and related international terrorism. Whenever you have that confluence of factors, the risk of agency operatives and officials going overboard is obviously present, and that's why it's all the more important that this latest round of activities by the CIA be made as fully public, at least, as the 1960s excesses were made by the Church Committee report.
And perhaps the most shocking thing for the American public to learn from this report is the ineffectiveness of these kinds of techniques. And then we were encouraged to believe the last few years that the CIA was able to get key information via use of torture that led to the arrest of the killing of Osama bin Laden, and now that is turning out to be completely fraudulent. Would this release of this report finally end that kind of supposition that these techniques are necessary for national security?
I don't think this report will end the debate. The leaked versions of the report indicate, for example, that in the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, one of the allegedly high-value detainees in the war against terrorism, that a great deal of information was obtained from Mr. Abu Zubaydah in the initial interview by an FBI interviewer. And then subsequently, Zubaydah was subjected to 83 instances of waterboarding. And when the CIA ultimately reported to Congress and the public as to the intelligence they received from Abu Zubaydah, they lumped it all together and credited all of it to the use of the waterboarding, when in fact, according to the Senate committee, most of the valuable information was obtained before they ever used the harsh interrogation techniques. Now again, the CIA has not conceded that point publicly yet, and until we see the full, at least the full executive summary and perhaps the full report itself, it will be difficult for independent observers to evaluate the conflicting claims between the Senate and the CIA.
Do we know how many people were subjected to these techniques? How many victims of CIA torture are we talking about? And how many fatalities can be associated with this period?
Well, we don't know, at least I don't know exactly how many people were subjected to these techniques, but the news leaks indicate that there are more than 100 case studies of the use of these techniques on various prisoners, on over 100 prisoners, in the Senate report, and that is dozens more than the CIA has previously acknowledged. So it's a larger number of people than we knew about. It sounds as if it's about 100, but it may be more than that. We'll have to wait until we see the declassification. Now, in terms of fatalities, there was, of course, the fatality that was memorialized in the a number of fatalities memorialized by the treatment of prisoners in Iraq at Abu Ghraib and in Afghanistan, but those were fatalities that resulted from military involvement. I don't believe any of the CIA prisoners, so far as I know, who were subjected to harsh interrogation techniques died as a result thereof, but they certainly suffered severe pain and suffering with long-term psychological and physical consequences, which is what torture does.
What are the legal ramifications here for these agents? Are they going to be subject to criminal investigations, or should they be criminal investigations?
There should be, but there probably won't be. Eric Holder, the Attorney General, took the position some years ago that for those agents and officials of the federal government, whatever agency they might be involved with, from the White House to the CIA to the military, as long as they operated within the very broad boundaries given to them by the authorization of torture under the John Yoo memos that were subsequently revoked, but as far as the Attorney General was concerned, that those people would be treated as if they were immunized by the legal advice they had received, and that he would investigate only those incidents where agents appeared to have gone beyond even the broad authority given to them by you. Subsequently, an investigation of a number of people under that standard was done, and it was ultimately reported that nobody would be, as I recall, that nobody would be prosecuted. Now, whether there is new information in the Senate report that would cause the Attorney General to revisit any of his previous conclusions, we don't yet know. At least I don't.
And there's no indication that anyone's being investigated above the level of the Central Intelligence operatives.
No, President
Bush, White House, for instance.
President Bush, for example, admitted in his autobiography that he personally authorized waterboarding. But he also took the position that he'd been advised by the Department of Justice, Office of Legal Counsel, that that was a lawful technique to use. Based on that, Attorney General Holder included President Bush within the concept of executive branch officials who relied on the advice they got from the Justice Department.
Are we not signatory to a UN treaty on torture that requires an investigation of such allegations?
We're not only a signatory, which is, legally speaking, the first step in joining a treaty, we are a state party to the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which requires in criminal investigations and prosecutions of anyone reasonably suspected to have engaged in torture. But the position the Attorney General is taking is that, yes, a criminal investigation can be launched, but not where someone has effective legal immunity because of a legal opinion from the Department of Justice.
Is the International Criminal Court going to see things differently in the possible future?
Not with regard to the United States, because the United States, while it's a party to the Torture Convention, is not a party to the treaty establishing the International Criminal Court. So the only way a United States person could be brought before the International Criminal Court would be either if the Security Council, the UN Security Council, referred the matter to the ICC, which isn't going to happen because the U.S. sits on the Security Council and has veto power. Or if you have a situation where a crime within the jurisdiction of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is committed by an American on the territory of a state party. Actually, Afghanistan is a state party to the ICC, and theoretically at least, Afghanistan could conceivably refer a case of U.S. torture in Afghanistan to the ICC, but that's extremely unlikely to happen because of the dependency relation of Afghanistan on the United States for economic and military support, at least until now. And secondly, because the ICC itself is highly unlikely to investigate an isolated case of torture. You would have to show that within the ICC's jurisdiction, so in this case within Afghanistan, there was a sufficiently widespread pattern and practice, widespread use of torture or systematic use of torture by the United States to warrant opening an investigation. And I don't think the number of known cases of U.S. torture in Afghanistan would necessarily reach such a threshold, even if Afghanistan were to refer them to the ICC.
Do you think Attorney General's holders' reasoning on this, that the people are immunized by the Justice Department finding. Does that make sense, or is that a political decision that he made? I mean, is that legally defensible, or is it just the case that the Obama administration really had no desire to get into an ugly public relations fight with the previous administration?
Well, it's clear that the Obama administration did not want to get into that kind of a tussle with the Bush administration. President Obama came in with a lot on his plate: healthcare reform, economic stimulus, energy, environment, and so forth. And he believed that picking a fight with the Bush administration would make things, his relationship with Republicans in the Congress, even more difficult than they have been. So it's clear that the administration didn't want to get into that fight. But that President Obama is one official. The Attorney General of the United States is another official. And whatever President Obama's political inclinations, I don't know that Attorney General Holder made his decision on any basis other than what he viewed as a proper application of the law. Now, the idea that because you get legal advice from the Justice Department, you can't be prosecuted, is one that may make some sense legally and practically in United States domestic law. Because among other things, imagine the Justice Department devoting its resources to trying to prosecute President Bush, and imagine how any jury would react when President Bush says, look, I got advice from my lawyers. I'm not a lawyer. My lawyers told me this was legal. I was trying to protect our country, and I did it. So as a practical matter, even if one tried to prosecute President Bush, it would be a very expensive proposition in terms of human resources and money with very little likelihood of success. That said, under international law, I think the United States has an obligation to prosecute, and the fact that somebody relied on erroneous legal advice is an issue that technically at least should be put before a decision-making judge or a decision-making jury to see whether that is considered to be a sufficient defense. But as a practical matter, I can understand the Attorney General's reluctance to take on these prosecutions, except in the case of people who went beyond the DOJ legal advice. And again, we'll have to see whether any such instances are revealed by this new report.
Well, Professor, you're an international law specialist. I don't know if I can, if it's fair to ask you this, to step outside your expertise for a second, but the Church has had something to say about torture. Are you familiar with the Catholic Catechism on the use of torture?
Well, there have been a number of pronouncements by the Vatican over the years, and you're right that I'm not an expert on either theology or Catholic social teaching, but I am a Catholic, and I have read some of the encyclicals over the years, and probably the landmark encyclical in this area is Pacem in Terris from 1963, Pope John the 23rd, and that makes clear, as have repeated encyclicals and other statements issued by, I think, probably every pope since then, that the Church regards human dignity as essential, and that in the modern world, human dignity is expressed in the form of human rights, and one of those human rights is the human right not to be subjected to torture. So there's no question that torture goes against the teachings of the Church, and I can say that even without being an expert on those teachings, just as a Catholic layperson.
Well, you're quoting Pacem in Terris, so you're a couple of steps above me right now, I've got to say. But we do know that the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference, Bishop Pates, has urged the Senate to declassify its report so that we, as you say, we can all get a look at what's in there and make decisions, informed decisions about how to proceed as a country, because, you know, obviously threats to national security will persist, and we have to decide what techniques are allowable, I guess. So the church position is that they are an affront to human dignity, and now we're finding out that they're ineffective as well. I think is that a fair assessment?
Well, it's clear that we're finding out that in the opinion of the Senate Intelligence Committee, based on an extensive and well-documented investigation, that the techniques were ineffective. I think it's still important for that report to be made public so that we can all debate on the basis of relatively full information whether the Senate committee is correct that we got very little information of value out of that torture session, or whether the CIA defenders who still claim that we got useful intelligence from it are correct. But in either case, neither church teaching nor international law would countenance torture, even if it were true that we got valuable intelligence out of it, which it now seems we may not have.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Notre Dame's Presidential Fellow, Professor of Law, Douglas Castle. Thank you for your time, Professor Castle, and thank you for listening.